logical explanation for this.
Okay, well, what we're thinking of as aliens are they're extra-dimensional beings.
Paranormal activity. Really exist.
The government knows about them.
Are we alone? Is there life after death?
They want the major population centers wiped out so that the few that are left will be more easily controllable.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another beautifully French press pot of conspiracies over coffee. I, as usual, am your host, Aaron, and today I'm going it alone, unless you want to count the guy that probably haunts my house. His name's Dave. Other than that, no Stu today. Stu wasn't able to make it. I'm going to do my absolute best to sit here coming to you from my bedroom. I got a little weird setup going on here, and I'm going to do my absolute best to talk to myself like a crazy person while staring out my window into the darkness and delivering you what I hope and consider to be a very, very interesting topic. So I'll start out as we normally would do by doing a coffee recommendation, let you know what I think of that coffee, and then we'll move on into today's topic. So let's jump right into that. We got a lot to cover today. Well, I have a lot to cover. You guys get to just sit there and listen, and I'm pretty envious of that right now because this is super awkward. But coffee, another one for my wife. I didn't want to take any recommendations out of the pot for Stu to not be able to enjoy, so I figured I'd let my wife pick one while we were out grocery shopping. And so that's what she did, and she chose 8 o'clock. Dark Italian espresso. And you'll also notice that I'm kind of sick, so it just makes matters even worse and even more awkward. But anyways, dark Italian espresso. It is bold, chocolatey, and full-bodied. Ooh, it says chocolatey. Hang on. Okay, I had to make sure they didn't literally mean chocolatey because I can't just have chocolate. I'm doing keto, as some of you may know. But yeah, so this was roasted in Maryland, USA. It is a dark roast, whole bean coffee, grinded it myself right before brewing it up for this podcast. So this is going to be a very fresh one. For those of you who don't know the rating system of the coffee, it is Nectar of the Gods, Excellent Espresso, Average Joe, Depresso, and Muddy Water. And I really hope my wife at this point wouldn't be capable of delivering me a Muddy Water, but here we go. Let's give it a shot. I have to reach like halfway across my room to grab my coffee. So I'm going black today as well. I've had plenty of coffee already today, so I'm really probably gonna start coming off as being a very biased person. Wow. Okay. So far, out of all the coffees that we've done, this is probably my second favorite, I would say. I'm also going to give this one an excellent espresso. It's got a good bite to it. I mean, it's definitely full-bodied coffee. It's very delicious. I should have thrown a little MCT oil in here, but maybe a little heavy whipping cream, but that's all right. It's still very delicious black. And out of the two top coffees that we've had on this podcast, in my opinion anyways, the Death Wish Coffee Company coffee and now the 8 o'clock Dark Italian Espresso, my two favorites, both came from my wife. I guess that's why I married her. But I'll set that down. So yeah, giving that an excellent espresso. If you hear a very loud noise right now, sorry, my neighbor decided it's a good time to start his truck. So, as I just mentioned, I'm doing keto now, the ketogenic diet. For anybody that doesn't know what that is, look it up. It's basically, some people say it's Atkins on steroids. I say it's the keto diet where you just don't really eat carbs. So I don't take in any sugar. I take in 20 net carbs a day, which I don't mean to bore you to death with my diet, but net carbs is carbs minus fiber minus sugar alcohols gives you net carbs, and then you take in 20 of those a day. So without boring you with that, if you want to know more about that, then go find a keto podcast to listen to, or just Google it, because it'll give you all the answers. And I'm sick of answering to people at work about it. IT Jeff knows what I'm talking about there. But, yeah, so while doing this diet, one of the things that I seem to be getting the most, because it's been a month as of Monday, as of March 11th, and I've lost this, I'm recording this Sunday night, so far I've lost 34 pounds. And, of course, I've put in a lot of hard work at the gym, Stu and I both have. And one of the most common things that gets said to me is, oh man, that's not healthy. That's not good for you. That what you're doing, that diet's not good for you. And the more I hear this, okay. And I mean, don't get me wrong. People are, they're coming from a good place. They are trying to tell me what they have learned to be what's best for the human body. But the more I hear it, the more I thought, you know what, is this good for me? I mean, I'm losing weight really fast. Is this actually unhealthy for my body? So I started looking into it a little bit. And what I've come to realize, you guys, is, and of course, don't get me wrong, I'm not a doctor. I've done a week's worth of research basically on this to bring you guys this episode. And it went from researching, am I doing this in a healthy way, to looking into the conspiracy of it. So, with that being said, I'm not a doctor, but how do I word this? None of us know what the hell we're talking about when it comes to health. I got to be honest with you. And as I'm looking into this, I'm realizing, like, everybody, you know, there's the very standard things like, oh yeah, you know, If you're eating mainly meat and fats, and you're not taking in vegetables and fruits, and you're going to be getting high cholesterol, especially with no fiber, you can't eat your Honey Nut Cheerios, which lowers your cholesterol, right? So I'm getting all this, and I'm thinking, okay, I'm looking into it because, you know, I'm a rational person that doesn't want to die because he didn't eat pizza, because quite frankly, I love pizza. So, and through my research, I'm like, wow. There's no definitive answers on what's healthy for us. The whole, you know, the food pyramid, it's all speculation. That's not set. That's not an exact science. Okay. And then I started thinking, okay, well, who really does have my best interests in mind when it comes to food, right? Because all of us have access to the same food. Everyone here in the United States, anyways. I don't know. Obviously, you know, people in Germany probably assume they have better coffee. People in, what's up, Renan and everybody, you know, that's been calling in. You guys probably have some cool choices we don't have, but we've got some good choices you guys don't have. And the point of my spiel here is I started looking in, well, who controls the, and who determines what food we're allowed to have access to, right? Because it's not like we're given access to every food that's discovered or every ingredient, I should say, that goes into different foods. There's always the process of running through. It's got to go through the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. Everything's got to be approved. And it's like, okay, well, with all that being said, and you watch cancer rates rise, and you watch obesity rates rise, and you watch so many different diseases, there's been diseases that have come out of nowhere that didn't exist before that are things now, okay? Even minor problems starting to, like, the rates in which these minor problems happen have increased. And I'm thinking, well, there's got to be some kind of correlation, right? Because everyone has basically the same access primarily to the same food. And that's one of the main things. Obviously, Canada, you guys have far better insurance. So some people here don't get some drugs that might help you guys and things like that. So the point of this is that I'm thinking, who makes that determination? Okay. And so what I as I'm Googling away and I'm killing little downtime at work, waiting for a new project, killing time at lunch, I come across this term, and this term is Codex Alimentarius. And I'm thinking, okay, well, what, that looks cool, right? And especially when you're Googling, is what I'm eating healthy for me? And one of the top search results you see is Codex Alimentarius. It's like, okay, you got to click that link to see what the hell we're talking about here. And turns out that's going to be a big portion of today's podcast. So if you get bored easily by, and you know what? No, this is probably more of a conspiracy anyways. So, just stick with me here. We'll get past my diet crap here in a second and we'll jump into these topics. So basically what I'm going to be covering is the Codex Alimentarius, the World Health Organization, the Food and Agriculture Organization, and the FDA, which is the Food and Drug Administration, because these are the government bodies, essentially, that make that determination of, are we going to allow the people to purchase and consume this food? So, starting with the Codex Alimentarius, because I'm sure a lot of you have no idea whatsoever what that is. So, in 1962, one of those beautiful, famous little commissions were started, okay? And it was called the Codex Alimentarius Commission, and it was formed under a joint sponsorship between two United Nations organizations, which were the World Health Organization and the Food and Agriculture Organization. As of today, there are 165 countries worldwide that make up the Codex, and they all apparently serve for the purpose of maintaining two primary goals. Those goals being to protect the health of consumers and to assure fair practices in food trade. One thing that sticks out in my mind right off the bat here is that you're trying to protect the health of consumers. I'm going to get more into that, but I want everybody to just keep that in mind for a second, okay? Because, you know, no, just keep it in mind. Keep that in mind. They want to protect the health of consumers. That's their number one goal. So the parent organizations, obviously the Food and Agriculture Organization, sorry, and the World Health Organization, they provide funding for a secretariat, which is a government administrative office, and that's for, they basically have the government help with organizational support services. Now, I would like to do the Dr. Evil finger quotes around help, because we all know how it is when the government helps. Regardless, and that's not a Democrat or a Republican or a liberal thing to say. That's what happens when government helps, is that they kind of just take over and it becomes whatever it is they want it to be. So anyways, the Codex is a government-to-government organization that conducts its business through a network of committees. A committee much like the one that was created there. I'll go over the different committees here in a minute, but each Codex committee is hosted by and also agreed to by the government that is responsible for the operation costs of each committee. So basically what that means is if we put India in charge of coffee, let's say, then India is in charge of setting their own rules and what needs to be adhered by, because they're the ones that pay for the operation costs. They obviously have to confer with other governments to make sure, but for the most part, it's them. They're considered the experts on it because they're the head of the committee, essentially. So think of your high school, you were the class president, what you said goes, which is completely stupid because you're not actually any smarter than the rest of us. But since you were the one elected, it's you that gets the say. That's essentially what's happening here. So the funding for the Codex Commission itself and the executive committees is the responsibility of the Secretariat, which is, again, that government administrative office. Okay, so they pay a government administrative office for quote-unquote organizational support services, but then these government administrative offices are responsible for funding the committee itself. So you see how it's a circle here and how it ends up being more of a government thing than it is just a committee of concerned neighborhood watchmen over a package thief. Okay. So let's move on from the Codex Alimentarius, because you see how the World Health Organization and the Food and Agriculture Organization, and more than likely the Food and Drug Administration, are all tied into this thing, right? So, and really, you look into Codex Alimentarius, what you're going to find is basically the structure of the Codex Alimentarius, but you have to look outside of that and look at the bits and pieces separately in order to see the real conspiracy behind it. So, first of all, let's start out with what is the purpose of the World Health Organization, okay? Because they were a big advocate for this thing. So the purpose of the WHO, we're going to call them WHO occasionally because it's easier to say. The purpose of the WHO is to both direct and coordinate health for its member nations, providing leadership and helping define paths for research. Okay, does that sound like a load of crap or what? So what does the Food and Drug Administration do? Now, mind you, they weren't necessarily tied into the Codex Alimentarius, but what do they do? Because they're they sound awfully related. So this is their mission statement, I believe. The Food and Drug Administration is responsible for protecting the public health by ensuring the safety, efficacy, and security of human and veterinary drugs, biological products, and medical devices, and by ensuring the safety of our nation's food supply, cosmetics, and products that emit radiation. You know, when you're talking about food and then my wife's makeup, and then you throw in things that emit radiation, it's a little bit concerning to me that that falls in the same classification and that the Food and Drug Administration is solely responsible for such a thing. But I digress. So also the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO. They're actually the oldest permanent specialized agency in the United Nations. They were established in October of 1945 with the objective of eliminating hunger and improving nutrition and standards of living. So they planned on doing that by increasing agricultural productivity. So they're assigned basically specifically with collecting, evaluating, and disseminating information related to the nutrition. So when you see things like food labels and things like that, they're responsible. They're associated with areas such as fisheries, marine products, forestry, things like that. So ultimately, what we're seeing here, in my opinion, is the making of another secret club, basically, that has a lot of government hands involved. Three organizations, one goal, all paying a government agency to be the proxy. That's how I'm viewing this so far. That was the more difficult to understand part of this, I would say. So if you didn't follow along with that, just kind of go back and piece through it, because that's kind of the basis for what we've got going on here. Now, back to the Codex Alimentarius a little bit. So we've got some general subject committees. So for pesticide residues, that's the Netherlands. Food import and export inspection and certification systems is Australia. Residues of veterinary drugs and foods, U.S. Now, mind you, the FDA isn't involved in the Codex Alimentarius, quote unquote, But yet there you see residues of veterinary drugs and foods, which ultimately tells you that they must be. And of course, that's one that's right here in the U.S. Nutrition and foods for special dietary uses is Germany. Food labeling is Canada. Methods of analysis and sampling is Hungary. General principles is France. Okay, so it also, I mean, we got commodity committees. I'll just name a couple. Processed fruits and vegetables is the U.S. Fats and oils is the U.K. Fresh fruits and vegetables is Mexico, which is like, okay, well, of course, the U.S. has to be the processed one, right? Because it wouldn't be the U.S. if it wasn't just a bunch of processed shit that you're shoving down your throat. Let's go over to some ad hoc intergovernmental task force. Food derived from biotechnology is Japan. Animal feeding is Denmark. Fruit and vegetable juices is Brazil. So it seems like a very structured thing, right? Because they care and they want to make these different segments be in charge of different areas, so that way you've always got eyes and potential areas of concern. But really, when you get down into the nitty gritty and you look at the whole thing as a big picture, it's ultimately not, the results aren't showing that. Now, just as a result, I guess I can say, even though that was kind of word vomit, back to my keto a little bit. So I use this sweetener called erythritol. It's, it basically tastes just like sugar, but it doesn't cause an insulin response. It's like, I think it's zero calories, maybe it's zero calories. I don't know. But all I know is it doesn't have any carbs and it doesn't cause an insulin response. And it took forever for that to get approved, which, looking at it from the perspective of, oh, well, you know, it could be cancer causing. It could be, you know, maybe it causes seizures. Maybe, you know, I understand that things have to be skimmed over before they're just thrown at the consumer. But I'm talking this stuff took forever to get here. I think it was derived in either China or Japan. I didn't expect to go into an erythritol talk. So I'm just kind of just going off the top of my head here. But it was either China or Japan came out with it. And it was fine. They used it. But it took forever to get here. And it's now that it's here, it was even more expensive initially. But it's still very expensive as a replacement. And it's like, well, there's your solution for diabetics who might, you know, because people that are diabetic, for example, you might have had somebody that wasn't initially diabetic, but they had sweets their whole life. It could be a food addict that has a hard time stopping, and they could literally kill themselves by, you know, consuming something that sweet. So here you have an equivalent that wouldn't hurt a diabetic, but you're not allowing it. So you look at, there's multiple ways to look at it. So yet here in the United States, the things that we're going to allow, like they're just perfectly fine and okay for everyone. And I have a small list here that I want to go through. Just give me 1 second, take another sip of my coffee. I haven't had to talk this long. Holy crap. I'm glad I'm not coughing in your guys' ears. That would suck if you're at work listening through earbuds and I'm sitting here coughing on you. So, as far as what things are allowed, artificial flavorings, okay? Because now, mind you, that erythritol is derived from a plant. Same with stevia, things like that. Sugar technically is, I guess, but it's very well known that it's bad for you, but whatever. Artificial flavoring is a blanket term that refers to man-made chemicals created to taste the same as natural flavors, such as vanilla, strawberry, or lemon. And because these are cheaper to use in most products, it's extremely common. I mean, it's pretty bad when you've got companies. I probably shouldn't say complete names now that I'm maybe poking them with a stick, but you got companies that advertise on their sodas that say, made with real sugar. In other words, hey, this is made by, or made with something that's not good for you, but it's not the one that's going to kill you. So look at us. We care about our people. Yeah. So You know, they're using it because it's cheaper, and that obviously is super common. And yet, there are studies that suggest that it might result in behavioral changes. Okay, minor, you can deal with a behavioral change, right? Maybe it's the caffeine getting to you that it's, you know, the product that it's used in. Well, you got high fructose corn syrup, too. Okay, this sweetener, made from corn. Gotta be good for you, right? The Indians loved corn. So, it's popular, and it's used by all types of different food manufacturers because it's cheaper and sweeter than cane sugar, and it maintains moisture while preserving freshness. So, it's got the preservative properties, and therefore they're going to use the crap out of it because if they can mass produce, it makes it cheaper for these companies. Understandable. Business is business. I get that. So, this additive is actually extremely common in processed food and is believed to contribute to heart disease. In addition to accelerating the aging process, it also raises cholesterol and triglyceride fats in the blood, making it more prone to clotting. So all you people who suck down a whole shit ton of pop, and then you want to come to me and tell me about how eating these beautiful meats that God put on this earth for me to eat is going to raise my cholesterol, you shouldn't be talking. You're sucking on a pop that has all kinds of high fructose corn syrup that is ultimately raising your cholesterol and your triglyceride fats in your blood, and it's also possibly giving you heart disease. Okay? There's a kiss on your forehead. Leave me alone. So, you got monosodium glutamate. Okay? MSG. That's the way everybody's actually heard of it being called. So, that is made of components naturally found in our bodies of water, sodium, and glutamate. But that doesn't mean that it's meant to be ingested. Okay, just because your body produces something doesn't mean that you should ingest more of it, i.e. too much sugar, ultimately leading to I forget whether it's type 1 or type 2 diabetes, I forget which one's the worst one, but yeah, you know. Okay, so anyways, MSG is reportedly the cause of headaches, seizures, nausea, tightening in the chest, a burning sensation in the forearms and neck. And it may also be listed as hydrolyzed soy protein or autolyzed yeast. Okay, so, and this is used in like snack chips and what else? A lot of different seasonings, a lot of condiments. I use a lot of seasonings, so I'm not going to complain as much about MSG, but these people, okay, these organizations that we're talking about care a lot about your health, and that's their one goal, is to make sure they're getting you those foods that aren't going to, you know, mess in a bad way with your health. Aspartame, the huge controversy with another, I'm not going to say the pop company's names, that decided to take aspartame out of their soda because it was claimed to cause cancer. And it's back in them now. Surprise, surprise. Look at the can. It's back. Yeah. And that one, people think that it can also cause seizures, headaches, mood disturbances, and as mentioned, cancer. Yet these people care a lot about your well-being. You got benzoic acid, which is, that can contribute to asthma attacks and hyperactivity, as well as headaches and digestive issues. That's found in ice cream, pickles, salad dressing, chewing gum. You know, all these things that you never think about. And I got to be honest, I don't remember what it was, but there was a man in Meijer back before I started eating keto. And I'm not turning into one of those people that's like keto and I'm going to cram down your down your throat that what you're doing is wrong. That's not who I am. I'm not going to eat keto the rest of my life. I'm going to go back to eating this crap. But we're talking about the conspiracy behind it. But there was this dude that approached me in Meijer, my wife and I, and we were buying our kid French toast. And of course, our five-year-old is with us at the time. And did I say French toast? I'm sorry. Cinnamon Toast Crunch cereal. And so, of course, our five-year-old's very shy. And, yeah, let's take a quick break from these depressing things. So he's a bit shy. And he's sitting in the cart, and of course his face lights up when he sees that my wife grabbed the Cinnamon Toast Crunch. So this random guy comes up and basically just like leans in, whispering to me and my wife, like, did you know that I forget the name of the chemical. He knew, but I'm forgetting, but I'm talking in this tone as that guy. There's a chemical in there that's used to make dynamite. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's what he's saying to me. Like, he's, yeah. Okay. Okay. And is that really what you want to be feeding your kid? You want to be feeding your kid dynamite fuel? And of course, I'm just like dumbfounded. And I'm, you know, it's like that whole where somebody asks you how you're doing and you're having your shittiest day you've ever had. And you're like, good. And you? It was kind of that same thing. So, you know, I'm like, oh, dude, no way. You know what? You're right. And of course, I grabbed the Cinnamon Toast Crunch out of my 5-year-old's hand, watch him about to cry, set it up on the shelf, wait for the psycho to walk away so he doesn't follow me to my car or something. But yeah, I'm not going to be that guy. All right. But I'm just telling you some different things out there. I have a whole list here, but I'm not going to go into it, all of them, because I don't really think there's a whole need to. There's maltodextrin, which is another one that you guys have probably heard a lot. There's coloring additives, believe it or not. You always see like I always hate it when I see it, but just due to the fact that it looks stupid, like, oh yeah, this is, there's red number 2 in here. Did you know that? There's in our dinner we got here, there's red number 2, there's a yellow 4. Yeah. These have actually been made illegal. Some of them have anyways. They've been linked to tests for anxiety, migraines, hyperactivity, and cancer. Hot take, migraines, anxiety, connection. Boom. There's my scientific take for the day. Look into it if you got anxiety. So anyways, moving on from that, I'm going to kind of just talk. Hang on, let me tear this. I'm going to talk without any assistance or anything at the moment. Because one thing I want to point out before I move into my next section here is that here we've had, since 1962, we've had these organizations teaming up because they care far more about us as people than they do about the sale, right? They want to make sure they're giving us nice, healthy things to eat and to drink and to consume for our bodies for nourishment. They don't care about the sale, right? Now, one thing I've noticed is I'm thinking, man, it just seems like everybody and their brother gets cancer anymore. And really looking back, it's like, if you knew somebody whose great grandma had cancer, it was like, oh, like that was like a life change, like almost, not to make light of cancer by any means. I live in today's era where everybody gets cancer. So I know a lot of people who have had cancer. And when you think about it, it's like, back then, like if you knew somebody whose great aunt's sister had cancer, it was like, oh man, yeah. And you're talking with somebody else who knows somebody whose great aunt's cousin's uncle has it. And it's like, you compare stories because like, that's how crazy it was. Or at least maybe this is all Mandela effect for me, but that's how I remember cancer from my childhood was, you know what? People just didn't get it as often. And it, I mean, of course, back then, there wasn't as great of research on it and all that. So for a lot of people, it could have been a death wish very quickly. And maybe that's why, I don't know. But a lot of the studies actually say that, because now to snowball off of different conspiracy theories, you look at things like, oh my gosh, I don't want to sound crazy, but I'm going to compare cancer in Area 51 for a second. Bear with me. It's a good point, I swear. Or at least in my mind it is. Tell me if I'm crazy. Feel free to email, call, text, whatever. But you look at things like Area 51, and the truth comes out there for a minute of, oh, well, it was an unidentified flying object. Not saying alien spacecraft, but it was an unidentified flying object. Okay? And then all of a sudden, you got people trying to cover the tracks and say, no, it was a weather balloon. Okay? They go back and they say shit that sounds really stupid. And that's kind of what I was finding in research, because I thought, you know what? If they're really out for the greater good, well, one of the biggest killers is cancer, right? So that should mean that if they've really cared for us that much since 1962, they should be preventing the thing that kills us off the most. Well, as a matter of fact, there's a lot of research indicating kind of the opposite. So there was a Times article, and there was an excavation that happened of a Scythian burial mound in Russia that contained remains of a man and a woman dead for almost 2,700 years. So according to paleopathologists, that was a mouthful. Yes, they're okay. I'm not going over that part. I don't even know why I put that in my notes. Almost every single bone in the man's body was riddled with tumors. Okay. The guy had cancer, but, one of the crazier parts about that is that this just shows you that you could look at somebody from that far back and know that, okay, they had cancer. So there are roughly 100,000 ancient skeletons that we have in the entire world's collection. And out of that 100,000, I mean, obviously a lot of them are just skulls, but we've got 100,000 different people, basically, that we're collecting, like some weird serial killer's basement. But outside of, you know, you wouldn't be able to track soft tissue cancers and things like that. But very, very, very few, there's no exact number given, but very few of those 100,000 have symptoms of cancer. There's maybe, dating to prehistoric times, they said they've maybe come across 200. So I guess they gave sort of an exact number, but it's not exact. They just said maybe 200. 200 out of 100,000. Now, let's go over today's numbers, because in today's numbers, you basically have a... Hang on, let me make sure I grab the exact number before I just tell you you're going to get cancer. Okay, yeah, I did. I do have it in my notes here. So, hang on. Sorry, there's one cough. I'll try to edit that out some. So let's look at the fact that whether or not the cancer rates have increased or decreased. Well, over the course of this time, cancer worldwide went from basically it started at like an 18% chance to a worldwide, it went up to 1 in 3 chance of contracting some form of cancer. And then now it's at roughly 1 in 2 as far as so basically you have a 50% chance of contracting cancer. So if you're listening to this podcast with somebody, look over at them, because I don't mean to be morbid, but one of the two of you could very well come down with cancer, statistically. So what's the reason for it? Well, you know, a lot of people, such as myself, would probably say that maybe those organizations that say that they care so much about you don't actually care so much about you. But the reason most research says is because there's a population boom. Give me 1 second here. That's right. A population boom is the reason why cancer rates and percentages worldwide have risen. Does that make any sense to you? That means that your statistic has been made stronger, because it's the more people that are here, the more people are getting cancer. So if anything, you sound stupid by saying the more people you add, the more get cancer, means that that's the reason that cancer percentages are rising. It makes zero sense to me. But yet, that's what they're going to continue to run with. So, hey, you know what? I'm not the all-telling eye that knows all these crazy health things or anything, but I'm just saying, it sounds a bit sketchy to me. So a couple of other random facts that they try to say is that it's also because we live longer. Okay. Now, this one makes a little sense. This one can hold a little bit of my coffee. It's essentially saying, well, we live longer than people did back in 1962. So therefore, the longer you're alive, the more likely you are to get cancer. Well, okay, I can deal with it when you're saying that. But when you're telling me that it's because we're adding more fish to the bowl means we're getting cancer, unless if everybody's breathing their cancer and it's an airborne pathogen, I don't necessarily think that that's the case. So let's move on from that just a little bit here. Cancer rates, just so everybody knows, in the past 20 years, the survival rate has doubled in just 20 years. So that's good, right? Early diagnosis has been a big contributing factor to that. People have more access to doctors, especially you, Canada. You guys are lucky. U.S. insurance sucks. But now, one of the main things that I wanted to point out is that they try to steer away and say, well, you know, we're trying to provide foods for you that don't increase your risk factors of getting these things, even though we've basically made it known ourselves that we're poisoning you guys through a lot of the food we give you. But yet I look at this share of population with cancer from 2016. It's a chart. Now, in this chart, the dark red, maybe I'll go and post a picture of this on the page. Hopefully I'll remember. Otherwise I suck and just remind me and say, Aaron, you suck. Maybe post the damn thing for us, please. But this map is, to me, the bread and butter, no pun intended, because bread and butter is bad for you. But this is the bread and butter for what tells me that it's what's in our food, the heavily processed food, that causes cancer, okay, and all these other diseases. I'm not only saying cancer, but I'm just using cancer because it's the biggest killer. So in this chart, you see places that are like, for example, Nigeria, Libya, Egypt, China. You know, China, of course, eats way more healthy than we do here in the U.S. India. You're seeing places that don't necessarily have the easy access to food that people in the United States, in Canada, Australia a little bit, Sweden, Norway, naming a couple of the countries with listeners for us. They don't necessarily have access to the food the way we do and how we process it and preserve it for so long. They don't have that. Theirs is more, they've got the fresh fruit, the fresh vegetables, the fresh meat, things like that. And looking at this map, okay, percentage-wise, so you've got countries like the ones that I just named that are coming in at almost 0% share of the population with cancer. Now, some people might say, oh, it's because those, you can't report on all those people because they're not as advanced of a society and civilization as US and Canada. Okay, well, that might be true. But we also, the United States also sends doctors there, and they do research these things. They wouldn't include them on their research on the world data. Okay. Now, you look at countries like Australia and the United States, and then Canada slightly after, Norway, Sweden. I mean, we're at the very, very opposite end. It says greater than 2% is what they can put it at. And that's like, it's all age standardized. This is share of total population. So it's like, the study was very accommodating for the fact that the test couldn't necessarily be ran, I guess, in all these other countries perfectly. And obviously based on population, United States, Canada, and the rest of us, we're going to die. Like, we're all getting cancer by the looks of this chart. And I'm thinking, huh, well, we're the countries that have insanely processed foods and insane things added to our foods that, of course, the codex tells us is perfectly fine, right? But yet here we are, and of course, a lot of these countries that were listed, I didn't see anywhere as being the on the committees, okay? So basically what I'm pointing at here, maybe it sounds like I'm rambling, but my point is that all of us countries that whose food's insanely processed and that we're part of the Codex organization and whatnot, We're the ones that are dying the most from these hard to treat, almost impossible to treat diseases. And so that's where your FDA comes in, right? That's where the Food and Drug Administration comes in. Well, let me put it to you this way. How many of you guys, by a show of hands, go ahead and raise your hand in the office as you're sitting in the office listening to this podcast. By a show of hands, how many of you have ever donated to one of those, you got the, you know, people that'll sell shirts or do things, those nonprofit organizations to where the funding goes to cancer research. I'll do an episode later on nonprofit quote unquote organizations, but a lot of them do have it's private research, so that's good, right? Well, okay, so Washington, in other words, our government, gives $4.9 billion annually for cancer research. And that's what they've basically done on average over the past 7 years. The global market for cancer drugs hit $100 billion in annual sales in 2014 and was projected to hit $147 billion by 2018. Those numbers haven't been revealed yet, but $147 billion of sales in the pharmaceutical industry for cancer drugs alone. Okay? Now, how are they using this money? This is something that hopefully, maybe I'm just passionate about this. You guys might have already turned this episode off by now, because maybe it sounds like I'm rambling because I'm passionate about it. But here's the bread and butter here. Okay? So we've got proportion allocation of revenue chart here. All right. This is from 2011 through 2017. 31% went to other. 27%, this is of revenue on that $147 billion, okay? 27% went to marketing. 19% was profit. 17% is research into cancer. 6% for taxes, which I don't know about you guys, but I mean, 6% is a sales tax to me. I don't know where you're getting 6% for the tax of your revenue that you're paying in, but it seems like you're kind of any cutting corners there. I'm no accountant, but yes, I am. So let's take that now. We got $147 billion. That's $39.69 billion to marketing, but yet only $24.99 to research. That's a $27.93 profit, but only $24.99 for research. Okay. Now, we got $8.8 billion you paid in taxes, but, you know, my point is, and I keep saying my point is, you're doing more to market these drugs for the cancer than you are to actually administrating them, making sure they're right, making sure that they've got a repeat rate, making sure you're actually healing people that are sick, making sure you're healing people's loved ones. Nope, you care more about marketing the damn product. You care more about marketing, chemotherapy? You're going to make one of those commercials on chemotherapy where you tell me that the side effects are basically everything under the sun, but I'm going to be cancer-free? Is that what you're doing? Basically, this is solely regarding cancer right there, okay? And there's about 100,000 human diseases that have been identified. 100,000 human diseases. And that's how they're going to treat every single one of them. They're going to spend more on marketing and they're going to earn more of a profit than they are on actually spending your money, your tax dollars, on research. And in my mind, maybe I'm going a little off topic here, but in my mind, they've got a cure for absolutely everything. Everything. Every disease that we know of that exists, they have a cure for it. But it's too profitable. Think about it. I'm going to move on and then I'll come back to that thought. Okay, so basically 1993, well, actually 1980s through the 1990s essentially were the golden age of the pharmaceutical industry. They gave a shit about us. There were chronic diseases where they were coming down for things. They accidentally came up with antibiotics in this time. Great. Booming, right? Everything's booming. I mean, they came up with different inhibitors, things for like different treatments for AIDS. They were coming up with treatments for everything. I'm snowballing now. I'm just going off of my memory from doing my research because I'm done even trying to hit you with facts. You know the facts at this point. Suddenly, things start slowing down. You realize that? Think about it. When's the last time you've heard of a cure for anything? When's the last time that you woke up to a news, to a Twitter posting, a Facebook posting that wasn't some stupid negative thing about somebody complaining about the government? It was actually somebody saying, wow, they came out with a cure for this. They've got a cure for that. Wow. Testing, you know, finally paid off. All the money that everybody's donated has finally paid off. You haven't. In our lifetime, if you're listening to this podcast, you haven't. And that's what's sickening, is that at the end of the day, everything came down to the financial risk of continuing research. That's what it was. Even though it's our money that we're putting in to try to get treatments of the food that you gave us, poisoning us, and we're trying to now come up with the cure so we can continue eating the food that you're allowing us to eat and poisoning us, but you won't release the cures. Because basically what's happened is the pharmaceutical industry caught on to their own game, essentially. Okay. The pharmaceutical industry, and by 1990, basically, they realized that they had very effective products that were making them lots of money each year. Okay, well, what do you do when you're making lots of money each year? You want to keep making lots of money each year because you're in business to make money, right? Well, they had patents that were generating billions of dollars a year, and they would continue to do so for years to come. So ultimately, you're going to protect your patent. And they knew they could probably find a number of new uses for the classes of medications that they already had. So instead of researching into new medications, they figured, well, we can basically repatent the product for this and have it be a cure for this. You know, so you've got that's why you'll get antibiotics now that are, oh yeah, that's for a sinus infection, but it'll also help your ear infection. It's the same concept basically. They're reusing their patent to, now it's for this. So that way they're protecting their own patent. So the most profitable course that they saw was to just coast, basically. So they put no more funding into new foundational research. And they just kept pushing the work that they already had in front of them. The work that really, to this day, I guess, considering a lot of the success was through the 70s, 80s, and early 90s, a lot of today's scientists don't even get that. You know, they don't get that chance to really dig in and try to find a cure for something. In my opinion, it's because they already, I mean, they probably don't know about it, but the government already has it, so why waste the resources? So, meanwhile, as they're basically delegating the usefulness of these different medications to different things, their prices keep increasing, okay? Hey, Canada, you guys have it far better than the U.S., okay? So when you think about, let's go over, we're not going to talk cancer now. Let's just name a couple things. Depression, asthma, blood pressure, diabetes, cholesterol. Okay, so think of this. In October of 2012, the price for one depression pill was $26.35 per pill on average. Okay, that was for Abilify, 20 milligram. For Advair, 250 50s. For asthma, $3.97 each, okay, per inhale. Benicar for blood pressure, $4.26. Byetta for diabetes, $128.58 per dose pen, which is insane. Because in my opinion, maybe I'm starting to sound liberal. I don't know. Call me what you want to call me. I don't give a shit what you call me. But in my opinion, if somebody's dying, or somebody's got some type of disease that they can't control, they shouldn't have to pay because their body decided to have that happen to them. It should be just natural human instinct to help take care of each other. But maybe I'm crazy. I don't know. Cholesterol pills, $4.99 a pill. Diovan, $3.43 per pill for blood pressure. Heart disease, $6.80 per pill. Psychosis, $9.85 per pill. So they got all types of different pills, right? And those are the prices in 2012. Here's your prices as of July 2018. Depression pills, $40.40 up from $26.35. Asthma, $6.28 up from $3.97. Blood pressure, $9.35 up from $4.26. That's 119% increase. Diabetes, $283.34 per dose up from $128. That's a 120% increase. Okay. I don't know what this is, but it says antique bathtub sex. I'm just going to throw that out there. I've been skipping it, but went from 23 to 64, which is 171% increase. Don't know what that is. Antique bathtub sex. If you have antique bathtub sex, you let us know and we'll try to help get funding for some pills. Cholesterol, 67% increase. Blood pressure, 123% increase. Heart disease, 116% increase. Psychosis, 150% increase. Leukemia, 73% increase. And none of this shit is costing you more to produce. As a matter of fact, you can produce it more in bulk now because cancer rates are rising. So, I mean, really, you look at things from a manufacturing perspective, and anybody can tell you wholeheartedly that in manufacturing, if you can produce more, a higher volume, you do it at a lower cost, but yet here you are turning it back to the consumer for far more. And it's absolutely insane. Depression pills from $4.84 to $12.18 per pill. That person's depressed and is contemplating taking their own life. So you're going to give them 152% increase on a pill. And all of this is due to a broken promise from an industry in decline. And that's what it all boils down to. And I mean to make this like a depressing episode, but this is the truth. And this is what happens when you sit here and tell me that the diet that I'm doing isn't good for my health, is that I'm going to sit here and tell you that nothing that any of us do, regardless, is good for our health, because we've got industries that are more that claim to be out there for the benefit of our health, but are ultimately out there for the benefit of their own wallet. And that's what's happening. That's why you're seeing increases in every single disease known to man. And that's why you're seeing increases in the price for medication for every disease known to man, is to pad the pockets of those gigantic organizations in the pharmaceutical industry. That's what it all boils down to, people. And that's as far as I'm going to go, because I'm sitting here ranting in my bedroom. My wife's probably sitting in the living room thinking, holy shit, my husband's lost his mind. But sorry for the rant. If you didn't like the episode, hopefully you tuned out a while ago. If you think I made some good points, let me know. If you want to talk further on this subject, obviously I would love to talk to an actual person about things like this rather than just staring blankly out a dark window in my bedroom. So yeah, you can do that by getting a hold of us on the number there, 231-237-8329, I think is what it is. I don't know, that's Stewie's gig. Email at conspiraciesovercoffee@gmail.com, Facebook at conspiraciesovercoffee. Get a hold of me on Twitter. I'm mainly into football stuff right now because I'm a big football guy. But you can find me on Twitter at Aaron Conspiracies, I think it's something. I don't know. Find me. It's a picture of me and my wife. But yeah, get a hold of us. Get us some coffee recommendations. Please do us a huge favor. Go to Apple. Go to iTunes. Leave us those reviews. They help us out a lot. Give us those 5 stars, hopefully. Whoever left that 4-star, maybe go back now. Give us the 5-star. that'd be cool. Appreciate it. Yeah, get it and share us on Facebook. We got some fun stuff coming up. We're now planning our schedule further out so we can have better research for episodes. And we're just looking to bring you guys especially starting next week. I know this is weird with me being here alone, but especially starting next week, we're looking to bring you guys a lot better show, a lot more prepared. So, wow, this is going to be weird. I got to say both parts of the outro. Well, shit. whatever. Until next time, trust no one, question everything, and join us next week for a fresh pot of Conspiracies Over Coffee.